Welcome to The Wolf Den, the podcast about the business and people of podcasting.
I'm Chris Bannon.
And I'm Lex Friedman.
And today, our guest is Julie Shapiro. She's executive producer of Radiotopia, the network.
But before we get to Julie, first we're going to talk a little bit about shows we're jealous of. Our favorite section, other than the interview, where we get to highlight shows we like.
It's our only other section, actually.
But that's right. Shows we like that we don't make. So, Chris, what's a show you're jealous of?
I have two that I'm jealous of this week, because it's been a while since I've talked to you, and they've piled up. One is Missing Richard Simmons, which is sort of not fair, because we're sort of helping them make that show a little bit and get it out into the world.
But also not fair because it was going to be my pick, but whatever.
Go ahead. Another one. I'll banter a bit. You know, it's a wonderful show. When I first heard about the idea of doing the show, I was really excited about it. The first preview I heard was great, and the first episode, which came out this Wednesday of this week, the week we're taping this, the 14th, I believe, or 15th. Is just a fantastic story, and it actually made me rethink my own understanding of who Richard Simmons is and was, and made me see a lot of depth in his character that I didn't understand. And it was also an entertaining story, and Dan, the host, is actually terrific at telling it.
Yes, you feel very safe in his capable storytelling.
For sure, yeah. The other one I feel jealous of is Pod Save America. That was the other one you were going to choose, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Well, you should not let me go
next
first.
Next time I'm going first.
Yeah.
It's fine.
And you know that show, of course. Well, why don't you do it, since you like it anyway?
Here's what I like about Pod Save America is it's, you know, first of all, Jon Favreau and John Lovett and Dan Pfeiffer and the other co-hosts there, they built a great show with The Ringer and keeping it 1600. They decided to strike out on their own, and The Ringer was obviously very supportive of that as well, when they decided, hey, in this political climate, we feel the need to make something that's different from what Keeping It 1600 was. Like, they're trying, in my estimation, to be the alternative for the other side of the aisle to a Rush Limbaugh or a Sean Hannity kind of show. And I think they're actually doing a really good job. I think before they launched, it was an open question. What could they do and how would this network sound? But both Pod Save America and Pod Save the World, they found their voice immediately, which isn't surprising given their writing backgrounds. And their fans don't just love the show. They genuinely love the hosts. And that's a nice combination.
Yes. You and I will never feel that. But
no.
It's nice to see other people get that kind of attention. Now we get to ask Julie, I think, right?
That's
Julie,
right.
Do you have a show you're jealous of?
Well, I was thinking about Richard Simmons also, so thank you very little, Chris. Can I have two?
Yeah,
sure.
Okay, so one is The World According to Sound, which is just this little 2-minute podcast that comes out, and you hear, they just focus on a really spectacular sound for like a minute, a full straight minute, and then the hosts tell you a little bit about it. Maybe there's a short intro and then a long play of sound, and then it's done. Bam. And it's they're like little snacks of
What's
sound.
What's it called again?
And The World According to Sound.
Wow. All right. I'm writing
Two
that
guys,
down.
Chris Hoff, Sam Harnett. And it's just so simple and easy and obvious, and it uses the medium, and it reminds me that, especially now when I'm consuming so many podcasts all the time, I just, you know, I stop in my tracks for like 90 seconds and just let a sound wash over, and I love it.
Wonderful. Okay. What's number two?
Number two is Women of the Hour, the Lena Dunham show. I thought that they nailed the like smart, sassy, irreverent, feminist, political, funny, entertaining, thoughtful, all of those, tick, 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 right down the row. And so I would love to work on that show, make that show, be that show, et cetera. Yeah.
We'll send that note over to them. And
yeah.
Hope that they're listening. I mean, it's a beautifully made show, though. I you're right in all those ways.
And so. If podcasting didn't exist, Lena Dunham would have to invent it, because like what makes it so authentic is of the medium, I think, is hosts who can be really honest and open and transparent, and that's her whole persona. And so she's custom built to be a podcast.
Custom. And they also play with format. It's unpredictable. They get really serious, they go super goofy. I mean, they're just all over the place, and I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much for those two shows, Julie. And let's remind our listeners one more time, in case they somehow don't know, that you are, Julie Shapiro, the executive producer of Radiotopia, the podcast network from the Public Radio Exchange, affectionately known as PRX.
Yeah, I'd say mostly these days known as PRX.
Yeah, right. Public Radio Exchange is sort of an early aughts way of talking about it, right?
Yeah, so many syllables. PR, we go by, we're PRX these days.
And I mean, I've known you, full disclosure, of a very long time now, it seems.
Fake news.
No, this is true. Since I would say the late 90s, maybe at some point, right? And you founded the Third Coast Audio Festival in the year 2000, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, I got started. Johanna Zorn was working at WBEZ, and I landed there right at the right time. And together we started building up the Third Coast Festival. And that was around, yeah, I think it officially launched first conference 2001.
So,
but it took some time to get there.
So tell us a little bit about, for people who haven't had a chance to go and immerse themselves in the narrative audio magic that is Third Coast, tell us what it is and what it seeks to do in the world of audio.
Well, Third Coast was sort of founded to give creatively produced audio a place to be celebrated and promoted and supported. I think one of the early premises, like, is why could there be a festival? Why are there festivals for film and books and other artful forms, but not really for radio? So we thought, like, well, we'll start a radio festival. We didn't quite know what that meant at the time. This was like dark ages, pre-MP3s, pre-podcasts, all this. But documentary had really come into its own. WBEZ had already been a big supporter of long-form documentary work. So we kind of jumped into the fray and realized that the independent producer community was kind of scattered, and it turns out really looking for a way to come together. And Third Coast began to be this space where producers could gather, be supported. You could hear interesting new things. We put the international into the Third Coast International Audio Festival pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. I had the really great opportunity to travel around the world and get to meet a lot of producers from all over, bring some of them back to Chicago for our conferences. So we really tried to open people's ears to the potential of the medium again and new ways of thinking about the listening culture that was developing around us.
And it's interesting to me because Chicago, as the origin point of this, also was the home of This American Life. And it feels to me like in some ways the festival sprang out of the talent that was gathering around that show in its first several years, in the sense that, oh, there is an audience after all for long-form audio, for creative storytelling, for performance that public radio and certainly commercial radio weren't addressing at the time.
I think definitely. We always tied the sort of early years to the fact that the This American Life culture, both for makers and listeners, so you also had all of these young producers hungry to try to make that kind of work and push themselves beyond news reports and, you know, sort of standard day-to-day journalism that they might have thought was the only option coming in. So, yeah, it was just this really great time. I mean, I don't know how many times the word Renaissance has been kicked around in relation to that, but it really was a time where the people were seeing the possibility of pushing a little bit beyond the usual structures of narrative storytelling.
I have a question a little bit outside the content of the festival and more about the logistics, given that, you know, we put on our first big fan festival of our own last year, mm-hmm. Now Hear This, and boy, that's a lot of work. And, you know, we were fortunate to have one person on staff who had experience running events before. But, you know, when your expertise and background is what it is, how did you decide, know how to pull this off, or I'm going to be capable of pulling this off? And then how did it get pulled off?
It was so slapdash at the beginning. I mean, we just had this idea. It started we started with a competition. So it was sort of this many-headed animal by the end, or as it is now. But it started with a competition and a conference. Very quickly, we started a weekly radio show. We started doing public listening events. We did public audio challenges. So we called it sort of the festival that never sleeps. It was an ongoing year-round thing. We had events in Chicago all year round. It would really center around the conference, which started pulling producers from all over the country and the world together. And that's kind of what most producers came to know it by, was the conference. That would sort of be synonymous with the festival in their minds. But locally, Third Coast has a really strong presence throughout Chicago. We partnered with tons of artistic organizations in the city. And then the weekly radio show on WBEZ also really like landed the festival in Chicago as a kind of an important institution there now.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel, how would you say that the existence of the festival and its growth into all those avenues, has that changed the world of audio in some way? Has it directed energies in ways that maybe wouldn't have happened? This is your chance to brag.
Oh, I'd like to think so. I mean, we can point to some collaborations that are now very successful and high profile, like Jad Abumrad and Robert Krulwich met at Third Coast. I mean, there are all these, it was just a place where people would come together totally on fire with ideas, and they would keep in touch. It was really positive networking. We had a crazy dance floor. We like to say so many of the current public radio and podcasting luminaries like met on the Third Coast dance floor. But We really saw people meet, and we saw and heard producers get stronger and become the leading producers in the public radio system and now in the podcasting system. So it was always this place where new talent was coming in, established talent was looking for new talent. So yeah, a lot of matchmaking going on throughout the years over the festival.
It sounds like literally, possibly. Matchmaking.
Yes. Yes. Now, oh well, I do have stories. But
now here's your chance to prove that you knew it was coming the whole time. But did you anticipate the explosion in podcasting that we now see? Did you know then what we now know?
Yes and no, because I've never been like the technology side of things isn't my strong suit. So we were really kind of immersed in what we were doing, and then there were these inklings of this new way, new way to produce and deliver content. And I actually don't think I really understood at the very beginning the repercussions and the potential in it. What I did notice was when the technology started gelling and people were talking about podcasts and MP3s and downloads, there wasn't a great people weren't taking advantage of the potential for not having rules installed, and mm-hmm. they weren't sort of pushing against the status quo. So that's at the beginning we were a little bit unimpressed, I would say, because no one was taking the opportunity and really running with it.
Well, most people were just putting their radio show out.
Right. It took a while for the creative energy to catch up, and that's what Third Coast was always really focusing on, was like the new creative potential in this form.
And so you ran that festival. How long were you there? You were there 13? No, how many years? 13 years?
Yeah, so? About yeah. 13 plus, yep.
And then I wanted to ask you why you chose to go to Australia, to the ABC, rather than, say, taking yourself to a major market public radio station and attempting to drive that kind of creativity inside the system that you had spent a lot of time working in.
Yeah, well, the decision to leave Third Coast was kind of heartbreaking and also a really exciting one, just to realize it was personally time to move on and mm-hmm. and do something else. And I didn't know exactly what that was going to be. I mean, there weren't a lot of like radio festival organizer jobs out there. But, I realized I had some other skills, picked up some other skills along the way. I'd met a lot of amazing people all over the world. And the Australia job, it was creative audio. The ABC was starting a new unit as part of their Radio National Network, sort of the NPR of the ABC, if you can mm-hmm. stick with me there. So the CAU, the creative audio unit, was starting. It was this new thing, a great opportunity to produce two new shows. And the ABC had this long-standing tradition of supporting really radiophonic, rich, long-form experimental work. So I was very familiar with a lot of the producers there and a lot of their sort of classic work. So the opportunity for the job combined with the opportunity to go live in another country. I had a young child at the time, but my husband's a musician and he was game. And we just sort mm-hmm. of thought, why wouldn't you go live in another country and try a great job with great opportunities? So
can I ask, what was it like to work inside a state broadcasting system?
Because, very different.
Tell me some stories about that, because I'm curious. I imagine it's incredibly bureaucratic.
It sounds like corporate America already.
Yeah.
It was really different. I mean, to get back to your question about Lex, I think, like, how did you run this festival at all? Like, it was really Johanna and I, and then we had Gwen Maxey, who hosts ReSound, and a ReSound producer. That was the name of the show, the radio show Third Coast started. But it was a tiny little staff, and Johanna and I pretty much shared a brain. We made all the decisions together. And so going from that into an environment that was highly bureaucratic, lots of politics, very supportive internally and amazing mm-hmm. colleagues, of course, but sort of also inside this larger mechanics about being part of a network that was part of a state-sponsored radio that was kind of not loved by all the country. It was very liberal, and the government wasn't a big fan of the ABC at the time. So, there were sort of those big picture questions, and then there was the kind of day-to-day, the paperwork, the rigor of that was something I was not used to, we could say.
Do you feel as if they are or were well-positioned to adapt to the world of podcasting, or are they, and let's say the BBC and some of the other state broadcasters that we know about, struggling, and if so, in what ways?
Yeah, well, they definitely were starting to want to change course a bit, and I feel like I was really... for all of the difficulties, it was also an amazing experience, because there was this sense of like, how do we shapeshift into the future, or into the now, really. The future was already there. And so they were struggling a bit, and it made some of the complications even more complicated. The ABC was also going through cuts and layoffs kind of almost cyclically. So that was kind of happening. So some people were losing jobs while others were, you know, being brought in to try new things. And there was just a natural resistance between the way things have been forever and the way things might be right. able to be, and who was going to have control over that. There was, you know, a digital content sector, and then there were the producers. And so, you know, I think it was complicated. And I think one of the reasons I felt like the Radiotopia job was compelling for me was because it was going to be moving back toward working with a smaller independent organization.
And was there something that you took away from working there that you feel you can bring to Radiotopia and to the world that we all live in over here in the States?
Well, I was doing brand new things. The exciting part was we were producing two national hour-long at first weekly shows on a staff of 3.5 people
with. That 0.5 must have been stretched.
And that went down to 3 for a while. And then, yeah, it was really tough. It was a lot of work. So it was like total boot camp. I was actually producing more than I ever had been regularly at Third Coast, where there was no time to do that. I kind of just had to do some. Oh, and then we had a nice budget to commission. So that was also new for me, but very exciting to be able to pay people to do work. I was working with amazing, amazing engineers. The ABC sound engineers are like the top, you know, they're masters in their field. So there was a lot of creative growth I feel like I experienced there. And I was also in charge a bit, so I had to step up and make decisions and have responsibilities that I hadn't had before. So, I mean, I personally took a whole lot from that experience. In terms of what I learned, it was, I feel like I actually was unplugged a bit from what was going on here.
And
I had to really Well, it kind of drove me crazy. And actually, that gets to the point where I realized I really had to at least try for the Radiotopia job, because there was an American producer visiting, and she used to work at WNYC, and I was like, what's going on with NYC? And there had been all these movements and changes, and she just like looked at me and she said, you don't have to keep up with that anymore. you don't have to talk about this. And I said, no, but I have to. I'm driven to do that. So I realized that I still really care. I had worked so long in the American community that I really felt very connected to it still, and was feeling distanced and feeling far away. So well, yeah, it was time to come back at that point.
Before we leave Australia in the narrative, what's the podcast scene like there? Are the popular shows in Australia the same shows that are popular here? Are there a lot of original Australian shows that top the charts? Do U.S. shows make it a little, like, what are people listening to?
Yeah, there's a lot of love for the American podcast style for sure. This American Life, Radiolab, The Moth are big shows over there, and then there's also this like small but mighty independent. Emerging independent podcast scene, I would say, in the creative storytelling realm. There's actually a conference called Audiocraft, which started sort of inspired by Third Coast and very much has the same spirit of what Third Coast has sort of always stood for. And that's happening. That launched last year, and they're in their second year this year. Hmm. And the ABC is getting involved with having some kind of gatherings here and there. So it's definitely coming. They don't have the robust industry there. There isn't as much money being invested, but you've got some networks forming. And on the other side...
Listen, as Blue Apron moves there, it's going to blow up.
I think like Acast just announced a partnership there. So, I mean, things are moving over. You know, the distance is shortening, and there's also a small movement to sort of be Australian in the podcasting, and like real attempts to not just mimic the American styles and to find the Australian voice, I guess, in the podcasts. And, you know, the comedy scene is huge there. The talk shows are huge. So there's a lot going on outside of my sort of realm of familiarity, which is more of the creative storytelling. Nothing like what's here, but I do think they're taking sort of great inspiration from how popular things are here, and you're seeing more. I know BuzzFeed just launched their first podcast there.
Right.
So it's coming.
Well, speaking of things that are coming, we're about to talk about you got there to Radiotopia in 2015. But before we do, before we can talk Radiotopia, we have to take a quick break.
Way to keep them in suspense.
Mm-hmm. That's what we do. I learn from the best, Chris. We told you earlier in the show that we're all kind of feeling jealous of Missing Richard Simmons. That's because it's a great show. It's actually from First Look Media in partnership with the fine folks at Pineapple Street in partnership with us here at Stitcher. So, missing Richard Simmons. About 3 years ago, fitness guru Richard Simmons disappeared. He hasn't been seen in public since. He stopped teaching his exercise class at Slimmons. He cut off his closest friends and removed himself from the public eye. He had spent decades as one of the most accessible celebrities in the world, literally greeting fans when they would go by his house. But in the last 3 years, almost no one has seen him, and nobody knows why he left. Some think it wasn't his choice to disappear. Filmmaker Dan Taberski was a Slimmons regular and a friend of Richard's. Missing Richard Simmons is Dan's personal search to find his old friend. Dan talks to Slimmons regulars, famous fans, former friends, and family to better understand who Richard is and why he left. Missing Richard Simmons is not only the story of one of America's most iconic and misunderstood figures, it's also a quest to find him. And the deeper Dan digs, the stranger the story gets. You know, we paid for the show, right? So we heard a couple episodes early, and I initially said, I don't want any spoilers. And they sent me the first episode, and I said, okay, now I would like all the episodes, please, because I need to know where this is going. Subscribe now to Missing Richard Simmons in Stitcher or in iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you go into Stitcher Premium, you can get the episodes ad-free and get next week's episode early. Just saying.
We're back at the Wolf Den. I'm Chris Bannon. I'm here with
Lex Friedman. That's
thank
me.
Thank you. And our guest, Julie Shapiro. And she has been telling us about her career at the ABC and before that at the Third Coast International Festival. And right now we get to go to the latest part, the latest chapter in Julie's life, and that is working as the executive producer of programming at Radiotopia, the podcast network. Julie, what's different? How would you define Radiotopia as a network for listeners who maybe haven't thought about it that way? They may have found it through one show or another, but what would you say is the big idea behind Radiotopia?
So Radiotopia is a network of, we like to say, sort of cutting edge, extraordinary cutting edge podcasts. They're very different one to the next, all very independent minded. The shows all own their own content. We have generally sound rich, highly produced shows that are storytelling based, although we're sort of broadening that scope a bit now. But the real through line, I feel like, is a certain spirit of, yeah, of independence, of we sort of liken Radiotopia to a record label, a sort of an indie record label, a punk rock record label, where we're like a collection of independents that come together, and Radiotopia serves as the support behind that through the technology and building audience and gaining revenue. So we sort of help the shows ramp up and succeed, you know, when they get to the point where they need more support, but they're all independent, they work on their own, and they don't have that support. So that's where we come in. But yeah, we're sort of fostering a community, both internally between the shows and also amongst the listeners as well.
So is it difficult to foster a community with so many very independent people? I mean, I know some of your hosts pretty well, and I know how they like to work, and at least some of them. And it would seem to me you're in a very difficult job because you're trying to create a system out of a group of people who are really, in many ways, happier when they're not feeling too much part of a system.
Yeah, there's some push and pull between, you know, wanting direction and not wanting, you know, no one wants to be told what to do, and they're all independent. It's complicated, but it's also part of the kind of it's a rich challenge in the job, because I've learned so much about these, you know, that 16 shows with different ambitions and expectations and needs and fears and wants and desires. So, you know, we're all very close too. I mean, I have very strong relationships with all of them, and it's a really it's a great, you know, if as soon as one show has an issue and we resolve that, then somebody else might have some questions or problems. So, you know, it's a little whack-a-mole-ish with, you know, gentle taps,
that's
of course, on the head.
You have sympathetic ears here, believe me.
there were some knowing glances in here.
There is a real love between all the shows, and that might sound a little gushy, but we all got together last year for the first time on while I was in the position of EP, and, you know, just seeing everyone in the room who feels so strongly about the network and they're supportive of each other. And so, you know, everyone's in it because at the end of the day, they respect and like really appreciate each other's work. So it kind of works, as unlikely as that sounds. It does work. And at the end of the day, we're here to help them all through the pain points that they come to in producing. So there's, you know, that through line, of course.
I mean, to your point about the community, when you are considering a new show for the network, do you run the idea past other hosts in the network and say, we're thinking of bringing on X host or producer or show idea? How do you think this fits? I mean, how do you make sure the community is buying into itself?
It's harder now that we're at 16. You know, I wasn't there for the first iteration of Radiotopia. It was 7 shows. And of course, you know, PRX partnered with Roman Mars from 99% Visible on the network. So at the beginning, I think that there was a little bit more discussion between everyone because they were trying to decide together, what is the network for? What do we need and what can PRX provide and what's Radiotopia going to do individually and as a collective force? So now with the 16, it's just impossible. You know, we just went through an exercise trying to come up with a theme that we would all respond to over the course of 2 weeks. And so even just coming up with a topic that suited everyone, you know, that's kind of low stakes compared to bringing a show in. So, but at this point, you know, people trust us a lot. Carrie Hoffman, the CEO of PRX, and I work very closely with Roman on those bigger decisions.
Sure.
But other things, when we are facing fundraising, we're going to try to really have that conversation with everyone, take feedback all the time. We're very open to hearing ideas. It's just hard to get everyone in the same space, even virtually. So,
I wonder if Julie, you can explain on the content side. How do you know it when you hear it if you're picking up a Radiotopia show? For example, you host one of my favorite non-mid-roll podcasts, which is The West Wing Weekly, which is obviously tremendously different from a 99% Invisible or a Criminal or The Bugle. So what's the through line or connective tissue or whatever the right term is that identifies a show as, yes, this is a good fit for Radiotopia?
We use all those words, actually. Thanks.
Nailed
you know,
it.
And I think part of, so last fall, we brought on both The Bugle and West Wing Weekly at the same time. And both of those seemed a bit of a departure from the, you know, intense, highly produced storytelling shows that came out maybe twice a month, or, you know, once a month at one point, but now usually twice a month at least. And for us, the connective tissue on those two was had to do both with, they were sort of in the family with Hrishikesh Hirway, who also hosts Song Exploder. That was a project that was already in Radiotopia. We already had a great relationship with Hrishi. We also felt like West Wing is smart and relevant and, you know, in the moment right now, telling very important stories, even though it's not technically a storytelling show. So that just also felt like the right fit, the spirit of it, the attitude of the show. They're ambitious, they're hardworking. These are all things that we look for in Radiotopia shows. Same thing with The Bugle. Andy Zaltzman hosts, and his sister, Helen Zaltzman, has a show in Radiotopia called The Illusionist. So we're also trying to keep supporting the Radiotopians, keep supporting them in extended ways, and those just felt like very natural ones to bring in.
Can you tell us a little bit about how the support works? Because I do think you know, your network runs a little bit differently than ours and then some of the others out in the world. You have donations from listeners as well as advertising, and it's sort of an unusual model. Can you explain a little bit and maybe tell us what parts are working best and what parts are still a challenge?
Sure. Yeah, we have sort of a three-pronged approach to the actual financial support. It's through donations from fans and listeners. We also get some grant support. The Knight Foundation has been a huge supporter. The Sloan Foundation, some of our shows are supported by the NEA and the NEH. And then there's, of course, the corporate support through sponsorships. So we sort of we're invested in those three directions equally. They're all really important. The fundraising is tricky because there's such a volume of other content out there now. Mm-hmm. People are really, you know, it's challenging to keep people's attention. And
what do you do to try to get their attention? What's your secret?
We try to work with really excellent shows.
But I mean, there's a creative approach to fundraising in those circumstances. It feels like there has to
yeah.
be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, we do the once a year thing where all the shows get on board and, you know, we try to have us a galvanized kind of effort together. And they've been pretty successful. I mean, they were record breaking in the start. And because now we have ongoing sustaining support, you know, the optics look a little different, but the fundraisers have been really successful in the kind of outpouring of love that comes through those. Also is helpful for the producers to get a sense for how much the network is appreciated. And, you know, that has worked for us really well. I mean, we also are thinking of what are new ways to do that because, you know, of all networks, we feel kind of tasked with being creative and approaching that in an innovative way that will be just as successful. So we're sort of racking our brains to think, what worked 2 years ago and worked last year may not work in this year or next year. So what else are we going to do in that realm?
You know, a little known fact about Earwolf, one that we almost never talk about because it's been getting to be a smaller and smaller piece, is that Earwolf actually has on its website a donation link. And it has existed for years from before the company was able to sell ads, from long before we were acquired by Scripps. Mm. And early on, our founder, Jeff Ulrich, would talk about getting, you know, people would see him on the street if he was wearing like a Sklarbro Country t-shirt, and they would say, oh, hey, let me give you a $10 bill that he would then take into the office for the donation pile. And the hosts, my favorite story is Brian Posehn came in with a $1 bill and said, hey, a fan gave this to me on the street as a donation for Earwolf. It's still there. It's obviously a very tiny piece of what we do. But the fans who notice it, occasionally we'll get a little bit of pushback. Hey, aren't you a giant, you know, corporate-owned entity at this point? Why are you taking donations? Do you ever get fan pushback on, hey, you're asking us for money, but we also hear the ads? Because I know that we have gotten some of that. Or are your fans more understanding than ours?
You know, people tend to not hold that against us. I mean, the story is really like these, this really goes to support the shows that you love and helps, it helps keep these producers working for themselves. And I don't think people, it has to do with the trust level, I guess, but they really see what the network's doing and understand the network needs money to kind of support the shows onto themselves. And so surprisingly, no, I experience very little, and I'm like a hawk on the social channels. I just can't stop looking. But we, and especially right now, we had these challenge coins that were one of the things you could donate for last fall. And Roman had done this with 99PI and great success, like thousands and thousands of these 99PI little challenge coins that are like sort of bigger than half dollars, nicely designed. You just carry them around. They're just little objects. They're useless except for they make you feel good and they put you in a community of other people who have the same coin. And so long way of saying the challenge coins are sort of landing. People are taking pictures. They're all over Twitter. And just like seeing the joy in the actual... And that comes from supporting something you love and having something to show for the fact that you gave money to something you love. And I don't think that goes away. It's kind of steeped in the public radio mentality.
Sure.
But we really see a continuity into the Radiotopia community.
Do you do tote bags?
We did have one tote bag last time.
Okay. Yeah. It's funny. I mean, it is work to sustain that level of affection. You have to really keep an eye on everything everyone's making and hope that people are being sensitive to the audience and thinking about that all the time. It's another job.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of jobs, you ran PodQuest, a competition. And I heard, I think our crack researcher, Paul Riesmandel, turned up the number that you had 1,500 entries to this podcast contest. Explain what that was.
He didn't get it. He's close. It was 1,537. entries.
Paul's fired. That's
yeah, that's
Paul.
It. We're getting a new producer. Yeah. That's ridiculous.
Paul did great, but I love to say that number out loud whenever I can in this context. We had 1,537 entries to an invitation to send us an idea about, you know, like, so you've got a, so you think you have an idea for a podcast, mm-hmm. send it to us, we'll pick one to bring into the network. So we were expecting to get a lot of entries.
Can I ask what the entries looked like? Like, what did you ask them? How many words? How many questions? What did they have to
do? Did you require audio?
Yeah.
Yes, we did. Up to 2 minutes of audio. So it was about 10 questions. Some of it just, you know, straight biographical, a little bit about why Radiotopia, why is the show a good fit for Radiotopia, not another network, and kind of what do you like to listen to? And then, audio, an audio submission as well. And it didn't have to be a sample. It could just be tell us about what the show will sound like. Give us a sense of something of what we would hear.
So 3,000 minutes, 3,074 minutes of audio. How did you manage to get through all that? Did you have a team of people, I assume?
Well, I spent an entire trip in Amsterdam listening to PodQuest entries and not saying anything. we had about 11 people total, and every entry got at least two sets of ears on it. And then those were PRX staff and some Radiotopia producers joined us. And then I think we were able through that to get it down to like, you know, a few hundred, and then slowly myself and I had a really wonderful woman named Chiquita Pascal working with me on this very closely, and we just listened, and I mean, it was really constant, and especially because half of those entries came in almost on the in the last 24
hours. Of course, yeah. How would you expect it otherwise?
Right. That's... I mean, I did run a competition for 10 or 12 years at ThirdCo, so I knew that would sort of happen, but it was really overwhelming because, you know, we're not really caught up, but getting caught up and then, you know, back. And we didn't give us quite enough time on the other side to really, we didn't anticipate that, the volume. So so we just plowed through it, and we got down to maybe 200, and then we got it down to 50, and that's when we invited, there were donors from the previous fundraiser to Radiotopia who had given at a level to help us shape the pilot fund, actually.
So not only can you give more money, but you can get to do more work.
Yeah. a real gift from us to them, to be part of the decision making about new shows in Radiotopia. Now, no one knew what that meant at the time, but what it turned into, I realized we could bring these people in to help us whittle the top 50 down to 10.
Mm-hmm. Well, so and, how difficult was it getting to the 50? Like, was it, you know what, there are clearly a small percentage of these shows that are far and above better than the rest, or was it a slog to figure out which ones to cull?
You know, when you looked at them, there were really easy yes-nos, but, I mean, there were a certain number that were, like, definite no's. There were a lot that were definite no's, like, you know,
sorry about
really
that.
Well intentioned, but, you know, but there were quite, you know, there were still 600 or 700 that were worth thinking about looking at. At least listening all the way through the 2 minutes. You know, I confess we did not listen to every second of every
I'm okay
submission.
With that.
Boy, the hate mail you're going to get.
Don't tell anyone, please.
No. Well, don't worry. No one listens
to the show. Yeah.
But there were a lot right there in the middle where you'd go, well, is there potential here? And then we had to be realistic and say, even if there's potential, can these people pull it off? And, you know, really start to understand who was bringing this forward. Of course, we were looking for new voices, diversity in content as well as maker. And so there were a lot of considerations going into what we were looking for. There wasn't a sort of a content goal.
Sure.
It was just something original that wasn't out there yet that, you know, was from someone hopefully we hadn't heard from yet. And so those sorts of guidelines were pulling us in certain directions. A lot of pitches sounded like shows already in the network or like directly said, this is the love child of, you know, 99PI and Criminal, so which I would tell them is not a great way to pitch your show to a network. That
oh, it's
has
nice that you gave them feedback. Well, so who was the winner? Who did you pick?
So it got down to 10 semifinalists, and the winner. And I think it's what's really interesting to me is where these donors came in at the 50 level and voted on their top 10. The one that ultimately won, a podcast called Ear Hustle, was in the top 50. But might not have been in my top 10, but it was by and large runaway top choice from these donors.
Huh.
And I thought it was so interesting that, you know, they are, of course, the listeners. They want to hear this show. So we had to, you know, give them a chance in the top 10. And after doing the interview with them, I was really excited about the project. But I think it was such a good lesson to learn that the, you know, as a person who's so deeply immersed in the industry and in the business of it, I had to listen to what the listeners were also telling in these decisions.
And so when's that going to launch?
So this is Ear Hustle, and it's actually it's a podcast coming out of San Quentin. It's produced by two inmates there working with an outside collaborator. A woman named Nigel Poor is going in to work with these two guys, Erlon Woods and Antoine Williams. And they're going to tell the stories of life in prison from the perspective of people living that life.
Wow.
And we are slated for 10 episodes launching in June.
Wow.
I think the Blue Apron ads are going to be tough to do, but I look forward to hearing it. I think.
Well, to your point, there will be a cooking episode.
Nice.
Oh, great.
Inventive cooking in prison. So.
I mean, that's great. It's a great idea. It feels to me just because you can really show people a life that they don't often get a chance to listen to and understand, right? And that there's the possibility of storytelling and of a range of emotions there is really terrific.
Yeah, and it's the story that you see fictionalized a lot, right? Mm-hmm. It's all over Hollywood. It's all over, and even told from a kind of investigative perspective a lot. But this is really, they care about the art. They care about the sound of it. Antoine's a sound designer. They have Pro Tools there, and they have a media lab in San Quentin. Like, this is a really amazing opportunity.
It's not my grandmother, San Quentin, that's for sure.
or grandfather's.
No.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? Just because you received not only these, you know, 1,537 entries, but pitches probably all the time. Coming out of this process, what would you tell someone who's attempting to pitch a show to do or not do now?
Oh, well, I had a list of about 15 tips on the heels of that, along with like a taxonomy of new podcast genres based
like
on all the entries. yeah, I thought it's in progress. I mean, the biggest takeaway for me was, you know, coming up, I was reading a lot of pitches that were not original at all, like they already exist or they were very generic, like telling extraordinary stories of ordinary people. Lots of that, lots of, you know, shows to help you. There was just a lot of generalness in the pitches, mm-hmm. and not a lot of specificity. So, and a lot of them are sort of overwritten and overdone. So I wanted people to pull back a little bit, focus on details, give solid examples of what, you know, a show could be, how it would get there, what it would sound like, a few sample episodes. So, yeah, I mean, most people just didn't have concrete ideas for sustainable shows. They had a starting point idea, but they didn't have a sense of how that would develop over time and continuously week after week or every 2 weeks.
Right.
Now, one thing we always try to do at the near the end of a Wolfden episode is try to get, you know, more advice of the kind that Chris was just pumping you for. What's the I guess the question that we think about here a lot is just there's so many shows out there and there's so many shows being made, so many shows being added all the time. How do you find new unique stories to tell and new unique shows to create? Do you think there is still room with all the advances, all the additional shows that have come into the market over the past several years for new independent voices in the space?
Yes, yes, definitely. I mean, the challenge is finding them, keeping them front and center, absolutely finding the time of the day. But I don't know how much listening you guys get to do, but, you know, of course,
the volume is... Oh, I stopped. I stopped about a year ago. Just gave
up. Took your life back.
Yeah.
Yeah, it there's always room for more. I feel like there's always ways to find a new place to be creative in. You know, I probably hear a couple of new shows every week. And it's not that I hear something brand new and original, but I'm definitely hearing new voices trying to do different things. And, you know, it's so now there's so much out there that you can really speak to a smaller crowd. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be the biggest podcast on at the top of the charts. But depending on what your goal is with a show, I mean, I think it's a perfect time to express some individuality and, you know, for producers to do something different and original. And, you know, I think sort of going beyond just the conversation for me is personally mm-hmm. what I find most interesting. And it's a lot of what the Radiotopia shows do. But we're also willing to kind of experiment with new things as well. So
I wanted to ask you, what trends generally in creativity do you see emerging? Or are you noticing anything about the producers who are bringing brand new ideas and projects to you that seem to be moving things in a different direction? You know, we can think about public radio and various shows going back through its history that changed the way people perceived that medium. And I'm wondering if you are seeing anything on the horizon that you think, oh, well, that could be the start of something big.
Well, I feel like I'm seeing a lot more shows that kind of set things up bit more, like go out and have focus groups and include that kind of tape, set up situations, tape that, work with that. You had just off the top of my head, like there was that sleepover podcast from the CBC where they put people in a hotel room and, you know, recorded them for 24 hours and then made a show out of that. So this kind of effort to, it's like slightly reality based, but it's also, you know, they got to true stories about the people helping each other. And I mean, that's just one example. I feel like there are a lot of shows that are leaving the studio, going out into the world, trying to do things and, you know, finding ways to be unpredictable and surprising and still tell important stories. I mean, for me, there's also the kind of explosion of the politics shows now and the shows that are trying to make sense of the world. And even when I was talking women of the hour, you know, trying to find a way to talk about what's going on around us in a meaningful and creative way. Mm-hmm. And a little bit of format play in that one, which I had mentioned, you know, what comes to mind is like they had like the inner thoughts of cats sprinkled throughout one episode. And, you know, it didn't always work, but they right. tried. And, you know, it just, you know, that playfulness. I just noticed I am hearing more fictionalized stuff, like little mm-hmm. moments of drama in even in like talk shows. And that's been surprising and kind of interesting. It's really hard to do any kind of fiction, acting, writing, all that. So it doesn't always work. But I'm interested in how much more interest there is in the fictional side of things.
Is there anything you're really tired of and hope doesn't cross your inbox?
I don't know. I feel like I'm pretty open to things, but yes, if I think for two more seconds, I'm sure.
Take the time.
I find the like, I think unless you've got really great talent with really interesting perspectives, the kind of me and my friend talking about X, Y, or Z, just, you know, for Radiotopia at least, just doesn't really work all that well. Mm-hmm. I mean, something that's magical about the West
Wing.
That's
the way Lex and I feel about this show, actually, but keep going.
You've got, there's something magical. With the West Wing, Josh was on the show, so you get this insider's, you know, sort of perspective on having worked on the show. And Rishi's got this super analytical mind. Usually he's talking to musicians about how they make their songs. But, you know, when he brings that skill into the West Wing, it's like the sum of the parts is much more than like two people talking about a TV show they love. So a lot of those shows are really about chemistry and, you know, saying something new about something that you haven't heard yet. So I would say the kind of reason to make a podcast is I get more tired by pitches that don't seem to have a really solid ambition, starting point, reason to even exist.
Can we bring our show to Radiotopia?
We can talk. We can keep talking.
Okay. All right. Call our people. Well, Julie, thank you.
If you could put some like non-narrated montages with extreme sound design in the middle, then I'd consider it.
I'm going to see if we can get Lin-Manuel to make a song where he edits clips together. But Julie, of course, thank you so much for joining us here. Where can our listeners find you and follow you online?
I'm on Twitter at JAtomic. So it looks like Jatomic.
Easy to spell and remember. Yeah,
it's just, you know, from forever ago. Jatomic is pretty much my handle across all the social medias.
And, so try it everywhere, and some of them will be you.
Yeah, try. Exactly. I also have a blog about personified teeth dental signs.
No, so you got to say that one more time.
Personified teeth dental signs. So dental signs with personified teeth illustrations on them, because they're everywhere. I have a blog that's been going now for about 10 years, and it had pictures from all over the world.
And the link?
There's just, it's, gosh, I never go to it. It's like ptteethds.tumblr.com, I think.
Pteethds.
Well, we'll put a link
it's
in the
funny,
show
it's
notes.
Like asking
I'm there
someone
right
for
now,
their phone
and it
number.
Is great. Personified teeth dental signs.
I feel like this is the big scoop of the show, actually.
I wish we had started this earlier, because I would have devoted the whole episode
to
it.
Well, we can do another episode on that. I just got two from Albania this week. They're not up yet, but this will inspire
me. Oh, well, so there's a cliffhanger right there.
I'm glad
stay
we're
tuned
get to
after
the
break. After a word from our sponsors, you can see some teeth on that.
Well, thank you again, Julie. Don't forget, listeners, you can subscribe to the show at Earwolf, Stitcher, or iTunes, and you can rate us in all of your favorite places to rate podcasts.
You mean this show, not the one about the teeth.
You can you can subscribe to The Teeth Show or to The Wolf Den.
Great.
I would also be remiss to not remind listeners that Radiotopia.fm will get you to all of the Radiotopia shows.
That sounds like a terrific place to go. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And we should thank our producer, Paul Riesmandel, and our engineer, Jared O'Connell, who's sitting in the booth attempting to make sense out of all this.
Better him than me.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you made the mistake of not turning off your podcast in time, so now you have to hear this cross promotion for Hello from the Magic Tavern, a weekly podcast in the magical land of Foon, hosted by me, a human from Chicago.
And me, Usador, wizard of the 12th realm of Ephesius.
And me, Chunt. I'm a shapeshifter, but I'm mostly a badger. But I guess I've also been an alligator and a tiny horse with a top hat.
If you want a fully improvised comedy fantasy epic, this is the show for you. You can start at the beginning and binge your way all the way up to episode 100, or honestly, just jump in on a new episode. It's not the Wire, you'll get it.
I join us, and we shall entertain thee hour after hour, o'er and o'er.
Also, speaking of The Wire, who's Stringer Bell again? Wait, which one whistles?
I don't want to talk about Earth stuff.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Want to hear Earwolf pilots before anybody else? We made a podcast feed just for you. Earwolf Presents is full of great stuff, like preview episodes for upcoming shows, peeks behind the paywall, and pilots for podcasts that haven't even been made yet. It's like getting to listen in behind the scenes here at Earwolf. Starting January 21st, Earwolf Presents will have a bunch of new pilots for you, like Edgar Montplaisir's The Wokest. Catch conversations between the wokest man in the world and comedians like Reza Lechea. Also, hear upcoming pilots The Florida Cast, Wow, You're Native American Too?, This Week in Sports, and Carl Alarm all throughout the month. Let us know what you think of them with hashtag Earwolf Presents. Subscribe to Earwolf Presents to hear more great episodes from around the network and behind the paywall, like an episode of Drew Tarver's Strictly Business with Derek Contrera, or Act One of Matt Besser's punk musical, Stolen Idea. Just search for Earwolf Presents in your podcast app and subscribe so you don't miss an update.